Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. This morning we talk poetry with two local poets. A little later in the hour, John Scoyles joins us, but first...
John Burson is a professor emerita of education and history at Syracuse University and also an award-winning poet with several collections of verse. Her latest book of poetry is Treasures Stored for Winter. Joan, welcome back to the program. So
Thank
it's
you.
Nice to see
it's
you.
Great to be here.
Your latest collection includes new poems, but also some poems that you have written over the years that you stashed away. So would you recount how you stumbled across those works?
Well, what happened was a group of us friends had got together last fall to talk about the fact that we were now reaching a time in life when we needed to be thinking about all the stuff we'd got in the attic that we wanted to get rid of. And so we started what was called the Empty Attic Society. And we helped each other week by week talking about the things that we'd got rid of, you know, the stuff that you stuff away in an attic and the kinds of things that you had years ago, didn't really look at over the years. I didn't have an attic, but I did have a whole collection of poems that I'd written over time, often on the backs of pieces of paper, and I'd put away and then never really gone back over to look at. Some of them, of course, I'd put in the other books of verse that I'd done over the years. But these ones were ones that I went and looked at again because I thought, well, if everybody else is cleaning out their attic, I'm going to have to clean out my attic as well. And these are the ones that I found there. Some of them are fairly new and are looking back at the past, but others are ones that I wrote many years ago and had then come up again and thought, yes, this we'll put this one in.
And as we mentioned in the introduction, you've spent years in academia. While the House Sleeps is a poem you've said is about your life in academia. Would you read that one for us?
I will indeed. While the House Sleeps. 2:51 on the clock and the House Sleeps. I am a matador, swirling my red cloak before the bull, prodding it with my words, my two-pronged extending spear, till its brain shatters. Triumphant, I twirl before the crowd as a new bull charges toward me. One shake and my spear doubles its length. Deftly my words plunge to its heart, pry open the ribs to display the bull's anatomy, while I pirouette in flamenco skirt to the castanets of my colleagues. 3:25 on the clock, and I reach for the pillow exhausted with dancing. But now I am a trapeze artist, swinging freely from the hands of Buber, to Maslow, to Bern, who hang face down in air, their legs draped over the trapeze, and I, the thread between them, weaving my design in twists and somersaults, with deep breaths falling in space, with deep breaths tumbling to my bed.
The imagery of that poem is so vivid, yet one doesn't necessarily associate the physicality you portray with academia. So tell us more about what's happening in your life when you wrote that poem.
Well, I was doing a lot of work studying Martin Buber and Abraham Maslow and Eric Berne and all their ideas and seeing links between them, which I thought that in many ways other people hadn't seen, and I would be able to use it in my work and understanding the way human beings work. And so with this enormous, I don't know, aggrandizement of what I was about, I thought that maybe I could make a contribution similar to theirs. And so there I was doing it in my mind.
Right. So we mentioned the new book is Treasures Stored for Winter. Also includes some works written in response to social and political events. And Waiting to Rise is one of those poems. Before you read it, would you describe what happened on the evening of June 30th, 1982 that inspired this poem?
Well, some of you may remember this, that the Equal Rights Amendment was put forward over a number of years, and it had to receive affirmation from the states as well as from the Congress of the United States. And we were waiting that night for the very last vote to be taken that would make it at all possible for the Equal Rights Amendment to become part of the Constitution. And it was pretty clear that that vote was going to go against the ERA. So we all gathered around the pond in South Orange, New Jersey, in the dark, waiting for the vote to be taken. And the vote was taken, and the ERA failed to receive the requisite number of ratifications before the deadline of June the 30th, 1982. And so it was never adopted. And it felt as though the work of a whole generation of women and men who helped as well was really for naught at that moment. And yet we still felt the urge to continue the work we were doing, and with the belief that one day, we would be able to have an equal rights amendment of the United States Constitution. And this was an enormously painful evening. So we're standing around the pond, and we each of us have candle in our hands, which we've lighted. And this is the poem that I wrote at that time. I felt braided into others' lives, mingled beyond extrication. We stood together in darkness, each with candle flooding the pond with light, hope filling our eyes, even as the Equal Rights Amendment was snuffed out swiftly as the candle's flame. At the microphone, a woman led our singing, her voice filling the silence. Somewhere over the rainbow, we shall overcome, we shall overcome. Our voices echoed round the pond, our rights reduced to rainbow wishes, our determination punched down like bread dough, waiting to rise again.
You read these so beautifully, Jonah. It's just wonderful. Now, you've also had several different musicians set your verse to music. What inspired you to try that?
Well, I've been thinking about that quite a lot lately, because here in Woods Hole, I remember spending quite a few hours many years ago with Phyllis Kufler, who lived here in the summers in Woods Hole, and was really a person who pulled together ideas of how the various arts can be used to augment one another. So she perceived dance and music and art all being together, mingled together in a way that made more than the single units of themselves separately. And I began to think about the same thing with music for poetry. So I had started doing choral work in some ways with some of my poems, and I'd worked with groups of kids who would work with me here in Woods Hole and elsewhere in doing some work with my poems that were choral poems. But then I thought, well, I can go beyond this, because I knew some people who were composers. And I thought, well, if I said to them, look, here's my book of poems, why don't you read them and see if there's something that you'd like to do something with and make a piece of music from it? And lo and behold, they agreed to do it. Oh. And I never said what poems that I thought that they should
choose. So whatever
spoke
to them. That's interesting.
So yeah. I said, whatever speaks to you, you know, do.
Well, let's hear one of those poems set to music. This one is by Elias Lieberman, a local musician who's also the rabbi at the Falmouth Jewish congregation, and he chose your poem, Lessons.
What did you teach me? What did you teach me? To be compassionate, to weigh the evidence, to pause before deciding who is right and who is wrong. What did you teach me? What did you teach me? To argue forcefully each case, present the facts in order, and persist when challenged, yet to reach you through emotion.
That was Rabbi Elias Lieberman with Joan's poem Lessons. Joan, when you heard that set to music, that must have been hearing your poetry in song. What was that like for you?
It was very moving to realize that you can write something yourself and find other people resonating with it. And it's been quite extraordinarily interesting to me to be able to hear what other people find in the poems. And it, to me, then, that's what you do with poetry. You write poetry, and you write it because you feel it within yourself, and you feel emotion which you think other people will share, but you are never certain how, in what way. And everybody arrives at a poem from their own background. And I find that so intriguing about poetry, because it's very different from reading a book where you might, for example, if you have a book of poems, you don't read it the same way as you would read a book where you start at the beginning and you go to the end. Poems you dip into, and suddenly something that you read on a particular day in your life just clicks with your own ideas. And it's those poems that stay in your head. And it's those poems that you carry with you as a kind of, some assistance that you have in your own life for the rest of the time.
We're talking with Joan Burstyn. Her new book is Treasures Stored for Winter. One of the shorter poems in the book is Time of Reckoning. Would you read that one for us?
I will do, and I just want to have a word or two before I start it, because I think perhaps people now don't think in the same way about this as they might have done when I at least was younger and realized that now it has two meanings for me. So I want to speak about that. A time of reckoning, some people think about particularly as being the time of one's life where one takes account of what one's been doing in one's life and is called to account for it. And that, I think, is a very important component of a time of reckoning. But when I grew up in England, a time of reckoning would be maybe once a month where you did the reckoning of the books when you were looking at the financial accounts of whatever it was you were involved with. And so this poem, Time of Reckoning, brings both things into mind, both the issue of reckoning up the amount of money you have and the amount you've spent and the amount you've still got, and the same notion of the time of reckoning being one where you're called morally to account of your life. So, time of reckoning. Carefully, I count the piles of friends I value, our shared thoughts, intimacy, and laughter, like quarters, dimes, and nickels. And as I count them all, I feel so grand. For this, I say, this is the way to be rich.
So, what inspired that poem? A thought comes to you and you sit down. I mean, you know, some of you can, like the last poem you read, you know, when you're waiting for the vote, that is,
right.
You know,
you, that's very specific.
Your yes. emotions. Yes. But some of the other poems, you wonder, were you just, you know, sort of sitting there and something something comes to me.
Yes. Or something has been bothering me during the day or been concerning me during the day. And then I write about that. Mm. It's very intriguing as to when you look back and you think, what led me to write that particular poem at that time? And you realize that at least for me, all my life, when I've come up with events during my life, I turn to writing down my thoughts about it in order to center myself, I think.
We're talking with poet Joan Burstyn. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with poet Joan Burstyn.
Now, as you unearth the verse that you had stashed away, we talked earlier, some of the poems have been written a long time ago. What was it like for you to reread some of those poems? Did it sort of transport you back in time, or did you find yourself reading them with a maybe a new or different perspective?
I think sometimes I went back to them and looked at them and thought, I know what I was trying to say then, and I try to recollect it again and realize that I didn't quite make it, and then I could see how I could reshape something and mm-hmm. think about it again. But otherwise, I'm transported back to then, the time. That's yeah. when it was. And so you find yourself going back over. Sometimes I revise poems over a number of years. Mm. And then I think they do turn out differently at the end than they were at the beginning. Yeah. But that's all right.
Of course it is. Yeah. Now, you mentioned you spent summers in Woods Hole, and for many years you've been working with area teens to voice some of your choral verse, which you mentioned earlier. How did you get started doing this? And I'm just thinking, was it difficult to get willing teenagers? I'm thinking teenagers singing poetry. Was that a tough thing, a tough sell for them?
Saying poetry, really. The thing was that I had young people in my own household who were growing up, and their friends were in the house. And so I was able to pull them in. And then later, when they grew up, there were still some young people around in the area who I knew, and they would come. And I was friends with them, and then they would bring their friends in to do it. This has become more difficult as my children have grown up and my grandchildren are growing up now. Because my grandchildren also brought their friends in, and they still come to the poetry readings. This last month when I did a poetry reading here in Woods Hole, my grandson turned up with a girlfriend and a young man who's with him and his girlfriend, and they all went back listening to the poem.
Well, we have a recording of one of your choral works voiced by teens titled Three Pictures. We'll hear the third picture of that poem, Spider's Web.
Three, Spider's Web.
Around the table, sharing food, between soaps and newscasts, webs of conversation hang in the unswept air, latched onto, elaborated in the months, the years of wintering.
Why should I do that when you don't?
I want to buy some shoes.
We always end up arguing.
I want to go to a concert.
Sneakers are cheaper.
You didn't answer my question.
I want shoes, not sneakers.
I thought I'd explain that.
Why not go to the theater?
It seems to me we always...
So you don't care what I think?
Let's go to the mall.
Where shall we go?
Why not the city?
Let's stay home.
I want to read.
I want my shoes.
Can't we agree?
To the city.
Shoes can wait.
Listen.
Stop now.
It's me.
Who?
Me.
Listening to that voicing makes me think about reading a poem, then hearing a poem read aloud. And when you're writing, do you think about how a verse sounds aloud, or is that just not even cross your mind?
Oh, I always think aloud. I always hear it spoken and play with it, speaking it aloud in order to shape it. I couldn't do it, I think, if I didn't hear it aloud. The trick with that particular poem was it was meant to be a spider's web, and a spider's web I was thinking of as starting with this large area around the outside and going into the middle until there's just this one little thing, me, right in the middle.
Oh, we have another example of your work set to music, and this one is titled March Day, and it's composed by Jonathan Dinkin.
Seen the sun on budding branches and grass yielding before the wind. I have watched the snowdrops bow down their head, and the crocuses smile golden and purple. I have trodden at other times over springy tussocks, which shield a crisp lease of a long forgotten summer. Yet this is not the same. This first fine day has set up such a tune of life and love, such joy of birds and a forgotten simple sound. My body dances quite unbidden to harmony with things. I am bewitched.
That was Jonathan Dinkin, composer, and keyboards, Judy Stanton on violin, and the vocalist is Robert Lieberman. Does a work take on new meaning for you once it sets to music and perform? Because obviously, there, you know, we heard Elias Lieberman's interpretation of one of your poems, and now with Jonathan Dinkin's interpretation, and it may or may not jive with what you were thinking when you wrote that.
That's right. But it's wonderful. That poem, by the way, was written, I guess, about 65 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
It was one of the poems I wrote when I was around 20, and it was just amazing. And to hear it with this new life was just amazing for me.
Yeah. So when did you first begin to write poetry?
When I was about 7 or 8.
Oh, wow.
I just wrote poetry. The first poem that I sort of remember having written down was when I was about 8. And then I particularly began writing again poems during when I was growing up in London during the Second World War. Then it was a way in which I was able to express some of my, my fear, my tension at the time. And I did a lot of writing poetry then, and had a wonderful, wonderful teacher of English at that time in school. And she was actually a writer for the Observer newspaper, and came and was a teacher in the school, but I think she saw herself as a writer particularly. And she wasn't that good at commanding the control of the people in the class, but a few of us who were really interested in what she was teaching us would sit at the front of the class while the rest of the class at the back was doing whatever they were doing. And she was a wonderful inspiration for me. And I think it was then that I realized that I could write as a way to express my feelings. And I look at my poetry in a way as a form of autobiography, because over the years they've just been about what's been going on in my life.
Yeah, it's because you have a number of different personal and professional pursuits. You teach, you write scholarly works on history and education, you're active in community issues, you're a mother, a grandmother, so you've got all these different roles that come out in your poetry.
Right, yeah. That's great.
So let's see, your latest book, Treasure Stored for Winter, also touches on conflict. And as an educator, you've been interested in conflict resolution in schools. The poem Lament of Two Mothers is one of your poems looking at conflict that turns violent in the aftermath. Before we hear the poem, give us a little background on when and why you wrote it.
I was in Jerusalem. My daughter was living in Jerusalem during the Second Intifada. And we are a Jewish family, and she is a rabbi. And we were over in Jerusalem at the time when, in fact, bombs were going off in restaurants, and we would occasionally go out to a restaurant where we would have to go in through security and have someone at the door with a gun waiting to make sure that nobody walked in who was not meant to. And perhaps sometimes we would be maybe almost the only people there in the restaurant because people were so fearful of going to the restaurants. And it was while we were there, or just after we had been there, that a bomb went off in a school, in a bus, not a school bus, a regular bus. And the people in the bus were killed, and among those who were killed was the suicide bomber. And the suicide bomber turned out to be somebody, one learned later, who had a family himself. And there was a young teenager who was one among those who was killed. And I was so horrified by what was going on there at the time, and realized that the tensions that there were there were affecting both groups of people who were being involved with the killings. And so I decided I would try to write a poem which spoke to me as a mother. And I just couldn't get over the implications of what it would be for a mother of a teenager to see her, or to know that her son had been blown to pieces, and that there was a mother of a young man who was a father who'd left his wife and two children behind, and what that could possibly mean. And I can't speak before anybody who's Palestinian, really, other than to say I tried to get inside the head of that person. For the Jewish mother, of course, I don't know what she as an individual felt, but I know as a Jewish mother myself what it meant to me. And so I thought that I would try to explain that in the poem.
And so you have two mothers, and you're reading a part, and then the other part is being read by Dorothy Stracker.
Correct. She's reading the Jewish mother, and I'm putting myself into the role of the Palestinian mother. Lament of Two Mothers. The speakers are an Israeli Jew and a Palestinian Muslim.
I weep for my son. His many talents lost forever.
I know that my Muhammad found fulfillment in the way he chose to die.
The way he chose to die? The carnage that he caused? Blood spattered through the bus? My son, my Lior, on his way to school? Legs, arms, brains blown out? And you dare tell me that your son found fulfillment in the way he chose to die?
Yes, I dare to tell you that. My son did find fulfillment in the way he chose to die. I know within my heart he died in Allah's service. While I grieve, I hold his life was not in vain. He died victorious.
And yet you weep?
And yet I weep.
And yet I weep.
His many talents lost forever.
My dream for Leo was shaped by faith that God would grant to us a peaceful life here, now, in Israel. Your son, Mohammed, had one child, another on the way. Had he no faith in life?
His faith in life he gifted to his children. He forfeited his life that they might live in peace.
But who decreed that one or other of the two should die?
He saw no way but Allah's call to serve.
To serve? To kill himself. To kill my son. And yet you weep.
And yet I weep. He had so many talents. He might have been a builder or studied science, taught his children and others in the schools. He saw no way but death. And so I weep.
And so I weep.
There are many talents lost forever.
We have to find a way, a path out of our weeping, out of our pain.
We have to find the power to save our sons, our daughters.
We have to search for ways that lead to peace and understanding.
We have to find new ways to nourish hope and nurture life.
We have to rise up. Cry out, hear us, O governing ones. Give heed to our cry. We both have lost our sons. How many more must die?
So sadly, not much has changed in the region in the 10 years since you wrote that poem. That's a very powerful poem, Joan.
Thank you. It's interesting to me to feel that we still have not reached a point at which we can look at warfare of that kind, of any kind, in fact, in a way that allows us to bring about an end to some of the conflicts that there are. It's been an issue that's been on my mind for the whole of my life, because I grew up as a child experiencing the Second World War in a very different way from those who actually went and fought, because I was just on the receiving end of the bombs and the rockets at the very end of the war, and I lived in London, and I've never perceived war from the perspective of the glory that you can have and the comradeship that you can have. I've perceived it as being incredibly destructive. And I think as women and children suffer probably more than any other group. But maybe that's not true, because the men die in fighting, and the men are involved in it too. But in many ways, women and children have a very different perspective on war, I think, than others do. And I don't see any way at the moment that that different perspective can really gain a footing of equality with the other perception of war. So that's a little depressing.
Well, the book is Treasures Stored for Winter, Joan Person. It's always lovely to see you. Thanks for taking time to come in and talk with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up after a break, we talk with poet John Scoils. His new memoir is titled A Movable Famine. John Scoils has published 4 books of poetry, and his work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The American Poetry Review, among others. He's also a professor of writing at Emerson College and the poetry editor of Plowshares. His latest work is a memoir titled A Movable Famine, and describes his path from a working-class boy from Queens to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, and beyond. He joins us in studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Mindy.
So you were introduced to poetry at a young age by your mother, and you begin the book with a poem that she would recite to you in the bath.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read us that poem?
I certainly will. It's The Ballad of Reading Jail by Oscar Wilde. Strange choice, I think, to read a child. Here's part of it. Yet each man kills the thing he loves. By each let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look. Some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Some kill their love when they are young, and some when they are old. Some strangle with the hands of lust, some with the hands of gold. The kindest use a knife because the dead so soon grow cold.
As you mentioned, kind of a strange poem, maybe a dark poem to be reading a child. So do you remember what struck you about the poem as a child?
I do. The blood and the wine. And as I mentioned in the book, I grew up in Queens, and we had to go to our church was St. Bartholomew's Church, who was a saint who was martyred and flayed alive. And we used to have to march under the statue of St. Bartholomew, and he was holding his skin over his arm like a suit, like he'd just come from the dry cleaners. You know, I remember that night when I was working on a book a while ago where I had that memory. I asked my mother, would you go back to the church? She was still living nearby. And she said, yes, that's exactly, has a knife in one hand and the skin in the other. And so I think this was kind of it mesmerized me. It was almost sacramental, this poem. But she also had me memorize other poems, the Ballad of Gunga Din, and some other ones. But this was the strangest one, because Oscar Wilde is in jail for sodomy, and he's envying a murderer who says he's committed a real crime. So it was a strange... when I finally read the whole poem, I thought this was a bizarre choice.
Mom, what were you thinking?
Right, exactly.
So once you discover poetry, you're hooked, and you start to read Kipling and Poe, but it took you some time for you to realize that poetry wasn't just something from the past, that new poetry was being created all the time. So being in New York, it didn't take long for you to make it to Washington Square Park, where many artists congregated. So describe the scene there in the mid-1960s.
Well, first it took me a while to find out where I should be going, because I used to get the Village Voice and look in the back of it, and they had all these different poetry readings. But I didn't know that there was a difference between good poetry and bad poetry. All poetry was I worshipped. So I would go to Washington Square Park. There would be somebody who looked like what I thought all poets were beatniks. Anybody who had long hair and a beard and had a sheaf of poems and was, you know, declaiming under a tree, I would listen to very reverently. And I went to many galleries. I remember one called the Gallery Gwen. It was even in the East Village before that was popular, sort of dangerous neighborhoods, but just listened to poetry. And then I had the nerve to write to Allen Ginsberg when I was about 17 because I read Howell and it changed so many people's lives. There were books about what Howell meant to you. They all begin the same way. Every essay begins the same way. When I read this, I didn't know poetry could be this way. But I had the nerve to write to him in Cherry Valley, New York, and I didn't even enclose a self-addressed stamped envelope. He was kind enough to answer me with a postcard, which I still have. Hmm. Where I asked him, could he look at my poems? He said, yes. No, he said he couldn't do that. He couldn't write. He had hundreds of letters in a pile. But he asked me, he said, you should go down to St. Mark's in the Bowery. And Ann Waldman, who was one of the founders of the Naropa Institute, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics now, was running the St. Mark's Church in the Bowery. And she was very kind to me. And there were free workshops there. So that's when I found the New York School of Poetry, Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, and I took workshops with Dick Gallup and Lewis McAdams there.
Hmm. Well, and you were accepted to the MFA program in Iowa, and you write, quote, we were hell-bent to become poets, but we were students. Those who taught us were hell-bent to become poets, but they were teachers. We were all hell-bent to become poets, and all poets stood in our way.
That's right. It's kind of a funny a lyrical lilt to that couple of sentences. It's true. It was a very competitive atmosphere. That's what I was trying to capture there. And I think we were all thwarted by being overly ambitious in a way. We wanted to write, but we didn't know how to write. We had to learn. Our teachers wanted to write. They knew how to write, but they had to teach us. And it was a very cutthroat attitude. Mm. If someone did well there, other people resented it.
Yeah. And so how did that influence your writing, being in such a competitive environment like that?
That's a good question. I think that what happened was many of us, I would bet almost everybody, broke off into little groups of friends, supportive groups of friends, because we were not supported by the institution. I didn't feel anyway. I didn't have many conferences with the teachers there. They were absent for the most part. But I made terrific friends there that I have to this day. And by showing each other poems and lending books, and so we formed little communities within, friendly and warm and supportive communities within, I'd say, a community of the opposite emotion.
You know, I always think poetry is probably the hardest thing to write. And there's so many different styles, you know, and I wonder how you find, like, it's like an artist, I guess, who finds the voice on the canvas. How did you find your voice and your style? When did that come along?
I think that most poets change over their lifetimes. I think most voices do change. Some people have the same voice all the time. And there's an interview, actually, there's an NPR interview with Alan Dugan, who was a huge influence on me. And the interviewer asks him, how did your voice change over the year? And he says in that gruff voice that he had, it never changed. I have the same voice at 15 that I have today at 80. And he did. His voice didn't change, but I think, other poets have discovered different influences. And, for instance, Donald Justice was influenced much by Latin American poets in midlife, and he called that book Departures because his voice changed. I think he grew a lot, and I think we all do. So I think it's like some painters. They might paint the same scene for a lifetime, and others paint different scenes, over their lifetimes.
Of early Picasso, later.
Well, there's somebody who was very continually
changing. Growing. You make your way to Provincetown and the Fine Arts Work Center. How did the community in Provincetown contrast to the experiences you had in New York and Iowa?
You know, if I hadn't gone to the Work Center, I don't think I would know how to have conducted myself as a poet and as a teacher. It was a life-changing experience to me. And I'm still connected to that institution and have a great loyalty and fondness for it. There, if some one of us published a poem, and I remember Greg Pape, one of the fellows then in 1974, published the New Yorker, took one of his poems. We were very cheered. It was like a victory for all of us.
Opposite of Iowa.
Exactly the opposite, where everyone would have been threatened.
Jealous,
and,
yeah.
And no, it was... The models were Stanley Kunitz, who had such a large heart, and Alan Dugan, who would look at our poems, and Dugan would write back legal pages on your poems and hand you an envelope with legal pages of his critique. These people were not paid. Mm. They did this all out of the love of art and of trying to support young people. Both of them said they wanted to give to young writers what they lacked themselves when they were young. And the community meant everything to us. And Grace Paley was another one. She came a little later, but her one time she said, when someone said, "Grace, how can you read so much and give so much back?" She said, "Well, I don't think I'm losing anything. I think of myself like a fountain. Whatever I give goes up, it comes down, it replenishes, and it just keeps coming." And that was the attitude that that I found was a terrific model.
As you're mentioning, you got to know a poet, Stanley Kunitz, very well. Can you read about one of your encounters with Stanley?
Yes. He always welcomed people. He had the gardens are still beautiful to this day in his house. Someone's maintaining them. I don't know who, but he would invite fellows to go over to his house, and you'd walk around the garden with him. He'd look at your work. He'd talk about it, and then he'd make a martini. But here's a section that describes an encounter with him. "Stanley put on his glasses and read my poems while I browsed through stacks of new books. The mailman placed packages in the basket on the door, but Stanley did not break his concentration. When he finished reading, he spread them across the table, saying I should work on texture and to pay attention to my endings, which he said, quote, came thudding to a close, unquote. I agreed with the texture. Flat language was a weakness. But the endings, I worked so hard on my endings. Stanley said the poems were getting interesting, but then they circled back to the first lines. Worst of all, I was not realizing my whole self and soul. In these poems, you're only halfway down the well, he said. You must rake the bottom slime. I couldn't resist quoting the edict that drove my lines across the page like battalions on a forced march. Quote, what about Yeats saying that a poem should close with a click like the lid on a box, I said. The ending should be a door and a window, he said. It should close, but you should be able to look through it.
This you're conjuring up this wonderful image of what a mentor he must have been.
He was. Yeah. He was, and not only to me. He was more than a mentor. He was a father figure to so many of us. His door was always open. He would lend and give you books. Even toward the end of his life, he founded Poets House in New York City. He was always a friend of the young. Mm. And whenever you went to his house, it was surrounded by young people. And it's hard to describe him as a teacher, as a mentor. And I always say I got my education outside the academy, even though I have a couple of master's degrees, you know. What I really learned were the lessons that couldn't be taught in the academy.
Well, and you know, I'm thinking of Stanley Kunitz as this teacher and mentor, and I'm thinking of you now with a professor at Emerson, and you can see what he got. I mean, the students clearly got a lot of it, but he got a lot of it too. We talked before we began the conversation here that having those students really keeps you on your toes, and it makes you think, and it helps you grow.
It does, and it keeps you young. Mm-hmm. Because I remember Stanley criticized another poet close to his age as having, he said, he has no new buds. and I always remember that because I thought, gee, I hope I always have new buds.
Yeah,
I always
right.
have some new interest. But you're right, being with young people and when a student asks you a question about something you hadn't considered, you're saying, get rid of these cliches. And the student says, well, what's the difference between a cliche and an idiom? and it catches you up because you've been saying get rid of cliches for years, and now you have to think about that. So it does.
I'll get back to you on that. So the stories in your memoir are entertaining and in some instances kind of off the wall. There's a lot of drinking, a lot of free love. This is the 70s, after all. What was it like to reflect and write about this period in your life from your current vantage point as an older, successful poet and teacher?
Well, it was a lot of those stories I found myself telling with friends from the same age, and we would laugh about it. So I thought, I have to record this. It was actually enlightening after I finished it to realize how much had gone on there that was totally inappropriate. But in those days, it was everything
pretty
was accepted.
Normal, yeah.
It was the 70s was the time of total experimentation in so many ways. I think in one point I mentioned in Iowa City, trying to find a girlfriend, and the Iowa Book and Supply Store really encapsulated the two kinds of modes. There were two books, one that filled the bookstores. One was essential feminism, and the other side of the window was open marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, how you can have a marriage and be free within it to have other relationships. So there was a tension there that was, I think, that made people drink and do drugs as well.
Well, you wrote a New York Times op-ed piece in June of this year, and you basically said you didn't realize how prominent alcohol was in your life until an old girlfriend pointed it out.
That's right. An old girlfriend got in touch with me when I had a poem in The New Yorker and said that, that she had seen this helping her teenage daughter do a project for school. And what was I working on? And I said, well, I've finished this book. And I described it to her. And she said, well, that sounds like it's a lot about drinking. And I said, it's not about drinking at all. And then after that, I got off that email and I looked at the book and I couldn't believe how almost every page was about it, from college to Iowa to Provincetown to Yaddo, which is mentioned there, to even teaching. And it was shocking to me. I couldn't believe that I had immersed myself so deeply in my past and turned a blind eye to that condition.
Hmm. John Scholes' book is A Movable Famine. Thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.